Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and who remembers the north side of Williamsburg's waterfront in the days before the Edge condos, the millions of precious boutiques, and before Mayor Bloomberg? Daniel Campo remembers. He is professor in the School of Architecture and Planning at Morgan State University in Baltimore, a former planner for the New York City Planning Department, and the author of a new book which New York Times correspondent Sam Roberts put on a list of suggested reading for Mayor-elect de Blasio before he takes office. It's about the Williamsburg waterfront in the 90s in particular, and in general the virtues of informal, unplanned, and vernacular uses of space called the accidental playground, Brooklyn waterfront narratives of the undesigned and unplanned. So, Professor Campo, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
So you're writing about the virtues of the old High Line before the new, everybody loves it, highly produced High Line, the old Brooklyn waterfront, not the gleaming new Brooklyn Bridge Park and the Diller and Scofidio design High Line. So how come?
The good old, bad old Brooklyn waterfront, as I like to say. I'm writing about it, and I've been writing about it for a number of years. So the period of my writing actually bridges both the before and after of this transformation that you speak of. But what's remarkable is when you look at all of these new parks, and we have some fantastic new parks across New York City, and Brooklyn Bridge Park being one of them, the High Line being another. These parks are like wow parks. You know, I bring my students here, my architecture and planning students from Baltimore up to see them, and their jaws literally just drop open. But, you know, these parks, as wonderful as they are, and I do believe they're wonderful, they come with a lot of limitations. You know, you can't build a fire in one of these parks. You can't alter the landscape and do land art in one of these parks. You cannot practice loud music in one of these parks. And this older waterfront, this decaying waterfront, this vacant waterfront, this dangerous waterfront that everyone said we needed to clean up actually allowed for these kinds of activities and so many others.
Exactly where was, just so people have as much of a visual sense of they can, of the particular stretch of waterfront that you're writing about, the Brooklyn Eastern District Terminal, or BEDT.
Right. That waterfront is, as you said earlier, it's on the north side of Williamsburg, and it is approximately between North 4th and North 11th Streets. If you were coming from Manhattan, you would take the L train, get off at Bedford Avenue, the first stop, and walk directly to the waterfront three blocks, and you'd be right there. And that's indeed how many people did come. And the people who used that waterfront in an informal way came from all over the city. It wasn't just a local destination.
To do what? To play loud music?
To play loud music, to spin fire, to get that shot of the skyline, to socialize, parties. And there was also lots of people, just average people from the neighborhood, who came and they would play cards there on folding tables. The salty old Polish guys of the neighborhood would come and shoot the breeze and drink beer and occasionally smoke pot. And they had a little clubhouse that they built amid a bunch of garbage dumpsters, and it actually, that part of this waterfront was actually an active waste transfer facility, but it didn't seem to bother them that there was this sort of bad odor wafting over their little clubhouse and their barbecue. They hung out, they relaxed, they enjoyed themselves, and enjoyed the sort of scene around them.
And what's there now? What's right there now?
In that particular spot is the Edge Condominiums.
It is the Edge Condominiums, right there.
Yeah.
So is this, I mean, certainly not to glorify the Edge Condominiums, but is this nostalgia for the bad old days?
I guess in part you could interpret that, but I think there's a bunch of lessons about how we construct cities, how we perceive of cities, and these are the kinds of lessons that I try to impart upon my students and upon people who are interested in cities and in design.
So put it into words. What do we lose when we lose that kind of space?
Well, we lose the freedom. We lose the ability to make our own environment. And that's That's the dynamic that I describe in the book, the dynamic of making your own environment. When you think about what people do during their leisure time, think about planting a garden, for instance, right? There's something very satisfying about planting a garden, about moving the earth and putting the seeds in and watching it, and that visceral interaction with the earth. And when you think about all the parks we have in New York City, where are there places other than community gardens? And the community gardens are wonderful, but they're in a way few and far between for 8 million people. Where do we have an opportunity to get our hands dirty, to actually build something in public space? I believe that this sort of thing, to get your hands dirty, is this part of nature that we've kind of forgotten about. Like, we're very tuned into sustainability and systems, and we're tuned into sort of traditional recreation and strolling and sports. But we've lost this part of nature, and our parks, for the most part, our structured parks, do not deliver it to us. So this is one of the things that I think we're missing when you go down to the quite well-designed esplanade that wraps around the edge condominiums.
Daniel Campo, my guest, author of The Accidental Playground, Brooklyn Waterfront Narratives of the Undesigned and Unplanned. And listeners, do you prefer these kinds of derelict, if you want, free vernacular, as he calls them, spaces better than professionally designed and managed environments? Or do you think we need a balance of some of each and we're losing that balance in and around New York? Call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Maybe you're a longtime resident of Williamsburg or Greenpoint. Call us up and tell us if you remember those days, and call us up and tell us if you prefer the waterfront as it is now or as it was. Dumbo and Brooklyn Heights residents, tell us if you prefer the old waterfront there or the new Brooklyn Bridge Park. Chelsea residents, how about the old High Line over the new one? Or can we maintain some of each in the 21st century livable city? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Daniel, put on your headphones so you can hear the callers.
Okay,
and
great.
We'll take Will in Williamsburg first. Hi, Will.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I moved to Williamsburg 20 years ago, and I remember fondly crawling through the hole in the fence on North 7th Street to get to what is now the State Park and the beach that was there that had a great view of Manhattan. It's still there in the State Park in terms of the development that the guest is discussing. I think it's pretty neat that you can still walk on those rocks down to the water. But I do miss the old days, and I miss and I specifically want to address the fact, too, that it may be a little bit off topic, but we were promised so much, basically. You know, at first, the reason it was like that in the past was because that waterfront was going to be the garbage transfer for the entire city. And it took the neighborhood a lot, and it was the neighborhood who did it, who organized against it and said, no, please don't put it there. And at the end of that, there were promises that we were going to get the Olympic volleyball courts, that NYU was going to put all their practice fields there, and that entire waterfront was going to be park and open access. And when we finally got the garbage transfer sites away, then it became apparent to the developers, wow, there's a real gem right here, and there's not going to be garbage there. So all of a sudden it turned over to development, and rather than having garbage, we were restricted from it by making it private spaces that gave us slivers of lands that are manicured, as you say, but also keep us away. They restrict our hours instead of, you know, on the, like, as there is on the Hudson, the bike path right on the water. The bike path is on Kent Avenue, where they have to fight with truck traffic. And it really seems to me that it's a shame that the powers of the city see these quote-unquote derelict neighborhoods. And, of course, when I moved here 20 years ago, it's not like this neighborhood was abandoned. People grew up here. You know, there are people who've been there all their lives, and it's always been a vibrant neighborhood. You know, Domino's had jobs that offered to people in the neighborhood so that they stayed here and they worked here. And specifically, talking to one of the Domino's developers, they were extolling how they're giving us 5 acres there. And I said, you know, forgive me for not being happy that you're going to build us a 5-acre park. We fought against garbage so that we would have an entire waterfront. And now we're not only restricted from it, but we can't see the city through your towers.
Will, very passionate, and I really appreciate your, you know, how articulate you are about all that. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of Bloomberg-era zoning discontent rolled up into one beautifully expressed phone call.
No doubt, no doubt. I appreciate all of the ideas that the caller gave us. And one of the things I did in my book is actually very serious. I've chronicled all of that history that he was describing in the sort of second part of the book, the sort of politics and watching that waterfront, charting a transformation of waterfront from the 1980s to today. And he's right. One of the, I think, liberating things that draws me to this undesigned experience is precisely because it doesn't cost anything, precisely because it makes, as an approach, it makes the most of what we have right now, that we, you know, he's right. There was all these promises made at various stages in the game from the 90s forward about what would be there and how wonderful it would be. And the city, for many reasons, and the state, they were involved as well, couldn't deliver on those promises. So,
but at the same time, Bloomberg, who rezoned so much of the city, 40% is the number I usually see, areas including Williamsburg, moving them from industrial to residential space when we need a lot more housing in New York City. And many of those deals do leverage private development to produce public amenities like parks and affordable housing. The waterfront is completely transformed. Should the mayor not have pushed to rezone that land and then leverage private money for parks and other public amenities?
Good question. So the Bloomberg administration set out and did this massive rezoning. And I think, in a sense, the caller is right that it wasn't so much that the rezoning was the wrong strategy, but I don't think there was enough public give back in terms of what the public got. And the affordable housing that was provided, or that is being provided through all of these actions up and down the North Brooklyn waterfront, is really, when you look at it, it's going to produce a very small number of affordable units. And it'll do nothing to break the larger dynamic of unaffordability in the area of gentrification, of displacement. So I don't think that all of that development actually delivered on that promise. In terms of the open space, well, yes, it's delivering some open spaces, and but at great cost. And I think if the Bloomberg administration, and I detail this in the book, the Bloomberg administration had negotiated the park land purchases that's going to be Bushwick Inlet Park, which is just north of the state park, starting at North 9th Street up to the Bushwick Inlet. If they had done a better job in negotiating those land purchases and had done it before, they were in a rush, really in a big rush to do that rezoning, they could have taken their time and at least crafted a more careful proposal, one with some larger urban design controls and also with more public open space.
Mary Ann in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi, Brian. I'm happy to make my comment that when I was growing up, we had unstructured lot in the back of my friend's house, and that was better than any park that could have been designed by the best, because we played croquet there, we played softball there, we built fires and roasted potatoes and marshmallows there. We built snow forts and had snowball fights. And, of course, it was lost to housing. But it was just wonderful to have a place to create your own activities as a child.
Thanks for the story, Mary Ann. People tend to worship Olmsted and Vo, who designed Central Park. And yet you use the word Olmstedian in this book almost as an insult.
Well, I don't, not quite. Maybe you've overstated that. But I think the problem is that we tend to think of parks and public spaces within a few different paradigms. And one is this sort of Olmstedian paradigm of the serpentine paths and the meadows and nature that's more perfect than itself. And indeed, that's what Olmsted set out to do with these parks. And they're wonderful. They're refuges, but they are limiting, right? You know, when donors come and throw $20 million down for a certain improvement in Central Park, you can be sure that expensive renovations will make sure that people can't just do whatever they want. There's going to be restrictions. And so we need a balance. We need something in addition to the Olmsted parks. And New York has always had these places, right? They've always had, as the last caller noted, the vacant lots, the residual spaces. And New Yorkers have always exploited these spaces in interesting and provocative ways. And if you look at what the land art movement and the things that were happening here in the 1970s, and you see the kinds of art experiments that were happening on the Hudson River piers in the 1970s, you say, well, these were things that were very, very important to New York. They were quintessentially New York, and they helped New York stay the art capital of the world at a very, very difficult time. So I think there's got to be a balance. And, of course, I'm still working out what this balance is, too, but the first step is putting this stuff on the map.
Daniel Campo, author of The Accidental Playground, Brooklyn Waterfront Narratives of the Undesigned and Unplanned. And before you go, Sam Roberts of the New York Times, and I'm sure you were delighted to see it, put your book on his very short list of books that incoming Mayor de Blasio must read before taking office. He had five classics like Robert Caro's The Power Broker about Robert Moses and five newer books, including yours. So how would you advise Mayor de Blasio when it comes to planning or preserving open space around the ideas that you've been sharing with us?
Okay, that's a great question. As you noted, the Bloomberg administration has done such a thorough job in rezoning New York City and finding every bit of underutilized land that there's going to be less opportunities for de Blasio in terms of his land development policy. I do think in North Brooklyn, though, there's still some opportunities, and I would hope that Mayor de Blasio takes a good hard look at all of those development projects that are currently moving forward, and many of them just passed some milestones in the land review process this week. And potentially, the zoning is in place, and there's not much that can be done. There's going to be landowners are entitled to build the buildings that they want to build according to the rules of zoning, and that zoning is now in place. But potentially there could be some bargaining that's done. And the Bushwick Inlet Park, which remains this unrealized park that sits at the fulcrum between Williamsburg and Greenpoint, has a very fanciful and expensive design, and the city doesn't have the money to finish the land purchases on this park. And maybe we can do something on this site that's a little more interactive, that's a little more incremental, that's not about the final beautiful park, but maybe something a little more open and interim. And I would encourage the mayor to look at some alternatives for that particular site.
Does the mayor, or I should say, do you have the mayor's ear? You told me off the air that he follows you on Twitter.
Yes.
So
he's
that's
one
a
of
good
my,
sign.
My two-digit number of Twitter followers includes Bill de Blasio. So I wonder, he started following me a couple of months ago when I said something complimentary about him in a blog post, in a Twitter post. So I hope that he is reading my book and keeping in touch with my Twitter feed.
But his transition team hasn't called you to consider you for
yet.
Assistant and Parks Commissioner?
Not quite yet. I'd love to talk to them.
We are going to be talking in our next segment about a proposed soccer stadium in the Bronx. The one for Flushing Meadows Park died under the weight of community opposition to giving up more public space as organized space. De Blasio has said he has concerns about this Yankees-related soccer stadium in the Bronx. Have you looked into that at all, just to transition us to our next segment?
I'm only getting what's been in the media, but I do hope he takes a look at that proposal. I think the stadiums have been lopsided deals for the sports teams and the sports industry, and the city shouldn't have to give up much to keep the Mets and Yankees around and to get a Major League Soccer team.
Daniel Campo, is a professor of architecture and planning at Morgan State University in Baltimore, a former planner for the New York City Planning Department, and author of the book The Accidental Playground, Brooklyn Waterfront Narratives of the Undesigned and Unplanned. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, if you were the richest baseball team ever, yes, they play in the Bronx, and you had a stadium project for another stadium with a prominent British soccer team, should you get New York City tax breaks? That's one of the questions we'll try to answer right after this break. Stay with us.